I think to start off today's session, as I did yesterday, I will share with you a couple of assigned questions for your discussion later on to help you focus and look and reflect on your own lives as well. One question is, who or what might have been the reference points in your life? And I will talk about those reference points later on. But what might they have been in your life? The other question might be similar, that is to say, who were the significant and or really important people in your lives, people who have shaped you? And what I will be speaking about this afternoon are those reference points and significant people who had shaped my life. This is my story. It is very specific. And it's not an attempt to generalize for every Chinese person in this country. That's very difficult to do. And this is not an academic exercise to draw any vast, abstract, significant generalizations off of, though I will be sharing some learnings and some observations with you. Those of you who might be familiar with New York's Chinatown back about 40 years ago might be aware that there was one public school on the corner of Bayard Street and Mulberry Street, which is right on the edge of Chinatown and Little Italy. And it's probably one of the most fascinating public schools in the country. A number of years ago, I had occasion to attend a wedding in Chinatown, and one of the school board members from PS23 was at the wedding, and he was a little drunk and just rambling and talking. But you can tell as he did his sharing with me that he was extremely proud of the contributions of the Chinese in this country. And he was bemoaning the fact that all those records from that institution might be lost someday, and telling me maybe he could use a good archivist there, Roland, telling me what a wonderful thing it could be if he could just get at those records and tell the story of each graduate from that institution. As I share my experiences with you, this is just one person and the cluster of his friends who all grew up together in Chinatown. And I could understand what this gentleman was saying when he began bemoaning that fact, and he was wishing that he can get a historian or some kind of grant money to pull all those records together and tell the story of the graduates who had come through PS23. The school must have been extremely difficult for teachers to teach in, because most all the students who attended there from kindergarten and up are first generation immigrants' children, Chinese and Italian. No one spoke a word of English. Can you imagine being a grade school teacher in that institution? It must have been fascinating. That was the school that I attended. That was my first educational experience. And it was probably a very, very, what I could call it is a real gentle introduction into the American culture. I say gentle because I think the teachers all there were extremely sensitive people. Very caring and very loving people. I don't remember in terms of content, what I might have learned there, but I can contrast that experience with a later one I had. I remember on the first day of school, somehow I got there. I forget if it was a parent who had accompanied me, but from the apartment building where I lived to the school, it was less than a block, but for a little child, I remember even getting lost coming home, couldn't find the right buildings. The first day of school, the kindergarten teacher stood by the door when we were all leaving, and she kissed every child who walked by. And I remember, for some reason, when I got up to her, I hung around. She didn't kiss me, and I hung around, and she said, "Oh, James, you want to hug and kiss too?" And she hugged and kissed me. You know, that was probably, you know, the reason why I had never forgotten that experience is because that was how significant that touch and that kiss was for me. In the Chinese household, demonstrations of affection are absent. It's just not done. And I still remember when that happened to me, I was warm and I was glowing all over. I remember I was just elated. I, of course, for the life of me, cannot remember who that teacher ever was. But it was a very, very significant experience, that hug and touch and kiss. Between kindergarten and the third grade, I moved along the grades with all my classmates, and things went fairly smoothly. Nothing traumatic or significant that I can remember. There was a period there when a younger brother died, and we were still living on 37 Mott Street then. And the funeral that I remembered was very vivid. And I, for the life of me, I never knew how he died and what the circumstances were behind his death. All I remembered was that he was old enough to walk, and that there were a few occasions when I was holding his hand and walking around with him in the apartment building. A few occasions, few memories we had when we looked out the window and looked at some pigeons and fed some pigeons out of the windowsills. And then all of a sudden he was dead. And it wasn't until many years later, probably right after after college, when I asked my mother what the circumstances of his death was, and she told me that he had died of pneumonia. And it was the sort of thing that was very, very rapid and very sudden. And she had been very angry over it. She had never forgiven my dad for not taking the responsibility to rush him to the hospital or to the doctor sooner and earlier. But it was, that was the kind of thing that I didn't know about as a child. What I remembered most vividly about the funeral was the funeral home, where I was probably, it was before kindergarten, and the funeral home was dark, all the lights were dim, and there was the coffin and my mother sitting on some side crying and moaning and crying and moaning and wailing away. And my sister and I were both brought up to the casket to view the body once more. And that was a very, very vivid memory for me. And then the next scene was at the cemetery. And I remember after the casket had been lowered into the grave, and when the whole group of us began going back to the cars, I remember sitting in the car and hearing him scream. And I shared that experience with a reader when I was in graduate school. It was a fascinating experience because I think that experience had imprinted itself indelibly in my mind with religious questions, of one of which was the guilt that I felt as a child, possibly over having caused my brother's death, although there was no knowledge or information base for myself, and no awareness of what might have happened, But there was a sense of some guilt and feeling that I was involved in his death. And of course, it wasn't until later on, after college, when friends whom I had at graduate school suggested, well, find out what happened to your brother, which I did. But that memory was a very, very valuable experience for me as a child and as an adult. The kind of question that we raise whenever a loved one dies, and the sense of guilt and betrayal that we experienced during that time. It was the kind of experience that I lived alone with as a child. You couldn't tell anyone, and no one asked, but it was certainly a valuable preschool experience that I shared with you. The next memory I had, and it could have been because of Chinese superstition, but it was almost immediately after the funeral when we moved out of 37 Mott Street and into an apartment building on 47 Mott Street, which is just up half the block. And we stayed there until I was in the second grade. And it was at 47 Mott Street, in fact, that that's the apartment that I described to you yesterday, where it was just a one-bedroom apartment, and there was, in our later years, became chancellor for the University of Maryland in Baltimore. And Calvin became a very close friend because the two of us, although we had left the high school and had lost communication with one another, maintained a renewed correspondence after both of us entered higher education. And we were very proud of his accomplishments. Calvin was always the high achiever in our group. The other neighbor friend was Ming, who in his later years changed his Chinese name to an American name, Michael Wang. And Michael became a pediatrician. And both Ming and Calvin are now dead. They're deceased. They both died of cancer. But these were early childhood friends of mine. All of us were baptized together at the same time in a Lutheran mission. We were all confirmed together. We all went through the Boy Scouts together. We all went through similar kinds of experiences I talked about yesterday. And every one of us from the same apartment complex there had made what I would call a significant contribution to this society. We moved to Brooklyn for reasons unknown. I could hazard a few guesses, and that is that my mother wanted to live in a place that had more space, as well as my dad wanting to commute less to Brooklyn, where the restaurant was. So in the third grade, I moved to Brooklyn and attended PS 161. And that probably was one of the most traumatic experiences I had experienced, because in that whole institution, I think we were the only Chinese families there. And for a whole year, I was put into remedial speech and remedial English. You see, the difference between PS 161 and 23 is that night and day. At PS 23, developmentally, everyone was at the same level in terms of their speaking knowledge of English and reading knowledge, etc. But at PS 161, in an all-white or probably all-Jewish community, we stood out, and I was placed in special reading classes for the whole year. And at the end of the third grade, my parents were told that I would not be promoted, that I was going to repeat the third grade again. And as soon as that occurred, my mother said, "We're going back to Chinatown." Yeah. And we did. A number of fortuitous circumstances occurred. Her older sister, the one who had prearranged her wedding, her marriage, had moved to Morristown, New Jersey, and so the apartment on Mulberry Street became vacant, and we moved there. And I came back to the third grade in Chinatown. And meanwhile, all my friends in Chinatown are now in the fourth grade. So there are two generations of friends I have in school whom I relate very well to. The teacher that we had, Mrs. Carboni, in the fifth and sixth grade, was a wonderful instructor. And there were a number of things that, she said to this day that I still remember. And those of you who had heard Pastor Paul Nakamura yesterday will recall some of the things that he said that Mrs. Carboni had said long time ago in terms of the Japanese culture being one where it was important for them to study the ways of the West, and that of all the Asian countries there, the Japanese country was able to do that most assiduously, intentionally, and carefully. And my wife and I are very much aware of cultural differences, and it is true. I need to corroborate that. I think when we watched the demonstrations and heard of the shootings at Tiananmen Square in Beijing, remember one observation I made was those old men running China still think that they are back in the 19th century. It is that still that rigid way of dealing with the youth that I experienced that made it difficult for the old men to lose their face. And for example, one of the taboos that we grew up with in Chinatown with our parents is that you never, never speak back to your parents. You never challenge them or question them. They are the respected authorities. And I remember there were endless, endless squabbles and fights that we experienced as children when my mother would say, "You are a bad child, you must not speak back to me." And the words in Cantonese is, "Name ho bok zhui." Bok zhui means you're speaking back to me with your mouth. And it is a very, very irrational, traditional taboo. And of course, as a logical student in America being raised, you kind of challenge your parents constantly, but that was something that they never tolerated. If they say 2 and 2 is 5, you better believe that it is 5, and you don't correct them. And when I listened to the news and observed that the ruling powers that be in Beijing had decided to cut off conversations. It was the same response of generations that I had experienced. The old folks will not deal with the realities of today. Now I sense that in the Japanese culture that they would be more responsive to developments in the new world. But I'm not sure today, based on what has happened in Beijing, if the setbacks there would not have set them back another whole generation. Anyway, these are little pieces of insight I saw as a child, and I'm watching the old men deal with the youth there, and I'm saying, oh no, same thing, you know, it's the same thing, same cycle in that culture. Authority and power were being questioned, and they wanted to make sure that everyone understood who had the power. That's basically what happened there. The school system changed when we were back in the fifth and sixth grade, and the school system decided that PS23 would no longer graduate students in the eighth grade, and so that the top level at that school became more like a middle school. And we were transferred to PS 130, which is a major school that will complete our education in the 7th and 8th grade. PS 130 is on the other side of Canal Street. Now, I don't know if any of you know the geography there in Lower Manhattan or not. Canal Street is a gigantic 6 or 8 lane highway. It's a road because it's not an interstate. Maybe it's an interstate, but it's a major connection between automobiles coming out of the Holland Tunnel in New Jersey to the Manhattan Bridge. So it's a major connection that connects the mainland USA to Long Island or Brooklyn. And all that traffic there that goes through Canal Street is a horrendous dividing piece of geography there. PS 130 is on the other side. Well, back in 1945 and 46, that's an Italian neighborhood. And all these little Chinese boys have to go into Little Italy to go to PS 130. So for 2 years, we had experienced nothing but fights. And the poor teachers there just could not understand what was going on outside the classroom. And at that time, I was playing the violin for the school orchestra. And I still remember my music teacher, Mrs. White, who asked some Italian boy to give this sheet music to James. And the boy looked at me and says, "I'll give it to you outside." So we had a nice big fight over that, just to get the music sheet that the teacher wanted to pass on to me. And after the fight of course everyone is watching the fight, and so after the whole fight is all over, we all paraded back into the school. We all came in late, and everyone is cheering and singing songs, giving congratulations to the winner and so on. And the teachers watched the whole group of us parade in after lunch late and wondered, what in the world's going on outside? No one ever knew. My earliest memory there was that of a little Chinese boy. I still remember them by their Chinese names, and there's no way I can translate it to you, but somehow he was singled out as a target. And after school every day at 3 o'clock, all of us kind of just in a big amusement, well, let's watch and see how fast, his name was Gokye in Chinese. Let's see how fast Gokye can run today, you know. And of course, as soon as he got out of the classroom, he would just race, and there'd be maybe a dozen Italian boys chasing after him. And of course, the safe haven is on the other side of Canal Street. So he'd just race up Canal Street, up Tomas Street, run across the street, and he was home safe. The True Light Lutheran Mission is also on the other side of Canal Street. And we had our Boy Scout meetings there, our German Bugle Corps meetings there, Cub Scout meetings there, Sunday school meetings there. Of course, on Sundays, we experienced no threat. But whenever we had German Bugle Corps meetings or Scout meetings on Friday nights, again, we would either get a whole barrel of garbage rolled into our building, or we would know that when we were finished with our meeting and came out onto the street, Canal Street, there would be a gang of Italians ready to beat us up. I say this with a sense of humor now, because I think back in those days, they were very traumatic ones. We had one of our senior scouts who knew judo and boxing teach us to defend ourselves, and that was a way of life. In a sense, it was unlike any of the kind of gang wars that we read about today. And there was no knives or guns used, just a lot of fists and pushing around. Rather mild. But we grew up in that environment. It was a natural way of life for us. Got to be good runners, learn how to quickly defend ourselves, or to make friends, which is what I did. Big Joe was one of my friends, and he was an eighth grader who was about 16 years old, big Italian boy, spoke half Italian, half English, and he was my friend, and he made sure no one beat me up, or at least he made sure that the fights were even, and that it was one on one, and not 12 against one. So Big Joe was my friend. I guess most of us learn very quickly to make friends, to survive that way with the Italian boys. These were what I call foundational years. They were very significant in the sense that we had developed a great sense of community, developed a lot of friendships with adults during those years, and experienced trauma as well as successes. During those years, this was before high school, I had a scoutmaster who taught me how to play the piano at church. And he recognized that I had some interest in this area. And as it turns out, music had been prevalent in our family, I think maybe it's genetic there. But I have cousins who have gone to Juilliard and who teach music in Hong Kong. And I didn't know about them until 1984. And and my two sons are very, very proficient musicians. Music occupied a great portion of my time in my youth. Taught myself the piano with some help and never took formal lessons. And more significant years occurred in high school, and probably it was during high school when I would experience more racism from the standpoint of faculty now. In PS 130, I wouldn't even call it racism. I think it was just two groups of immigrant kids who didn't know one another's languages fighting and having a good time fighting among themselves, enjoying scaring one another, etc. But I think in high school I have had teachers who have deliberately silenced me by calling me Fu Manchu, keep quiet. And those years in high school were my four miserable years in the academic world. I would say, aside from that short stint in Brooklyn when I lost a year, aside from that sad experience, the next four sad experiences were the 4 years in high school. And I remember in my freshman year asking my mother, can I transfer out of here? I hate the school. Can I get out? And my mother said, no, it's a good school. You stay. It was the Brooklyn Technical High School. And I don't know if you know the educational system or not, but most of the high schools in New York City are district high schools, as it is most everywhere else in the country. But there are a number of what I call elite schools that admit students by entrance examination with all kinds of tests and recommendations from the school principal. The Bronx High School of Science is one of them. Stuyvesant High School is another. Brooklyn Tech. I think there's one for women, Juilliard, or Julia Richmond, and another one, Hunter High School. And these were schools that permitted cross-transfer no matter where you live. These were almost like your magnet schools in Tacoma, only these were even more elite because they had entrance examinations and they were very selective. And I got into one of them. Should never have gone to Brooklyn Tech. It was a high school to prepare students to enter the engineering professions. And most of our graduates went to institutions such as Rensselaer Polytech, Georgia Tech, MIT, number of polytechnic institutes in Brooklyn and New York. Most of them were preparing to enter into the engineering professions. My examination entrance scores were very high, and as I've discovered many years later on, I am a very, very visual person, and I have a great sense of artistic design and visually know graphic arts very well and scored very high in that area, and that's one of the major entrance examinations there. But aside from that, discipline was not given towards mastering any of the other engineering subjects. So they were four miserable years. So what did I do with that time? sad to say, and this is a sad commentary on Brooklyn Tech, and I'd love to go back there and tell them this today. No faculty member ever asked me this question. James, what do you do with your time? No one asked me that. I spent those 4 years playing football, basketball, studying ballet, modern dance, especially through the ballet class. It was a class for, there were many professional dancers in that class, so I met many dancers, professional ones, who were dancing all over Broadway. We had wonderful parties, and I went to all of them. In many ways, they were lonely years for me, because at the age of 13, I was already 5'10". I'm 6 feet now. I've only grown an inch since I was 16 years old. So when I was 13 years old, I was already much too large for my peers in Chinatown, who were mostly all 4 feet or 4 feet two at 13 year old. And so it became very evident in Chinatown that if James was to play basketball in the Chinatown League, he'd have to play with the grown-ups. And I was bigger than all the grown-ups. And so I was separated from my peers, and they formed a midget league, a junior league, and I couldn't play ball with them. And the scouts, whenever they played these tug-of-war games or Johnny on the Pony, you know, I was always the one to carry everybody, you know. And socially, my life was severed so that all my friends were college students and the adults who played basketball in Chinatown. And we lived almost a double existence, one at Brooklyn Tech, where I just went through the motions of going to school. And then right away, after hours, then I became alive with my sports and dance world and with my friends in Chinatown and uptown New York. Feel free to interrupt and ask any questions at this time. I don't want to just ramble. I think the most significant people that have influenced and shaped me during that whole period of time, none of them were from Brooklyn Tech, safely say that, was my pastor at our church, our Boy Scout leader at the church, our choir director at the church, and many of my peer friends who lifted weights with me, peer friends. I joined the Chinatown Barbell Club. I was the biggest one there, and these were all adults. And so they took me under their wing. I had a lot of older men who took me under their wing. They became very good friends, and they directed, steered, and guided my direction. And it almost seemed as if these adults had sensed in me, here's a lonely kid. They were very good to me, and they took care of me. They nurtured me. And one of my Sunday school teachers, Helen, whom I love, I had her in Sunday school as a fifth and sixth grader. And then when I joined the church choir, she was in the choir. They used to tour our choir all over the country in the East Coast in order to publicize that ministry. And so we would sing and give concerts in Detroit, in Buffalo, in Albany, in Philadelphia, and Baltimore. The church had a basketball gym where we had our Chinatown basketball tournaments. And all the best players were put together in an all-star team called the True Light Lutheran Basketball Team. So, the True Light team went to play in Detroit and got the pants beat off them. We went to play in Buffalo and we got the pants beat off us. Our pastor wanted to send the team out on the road to publicize the ministry going on in Chinatown. Oh, we had wonderful trips. We were wonderful in the Chinatown League, but we went to Buffalo and everyone was over 6'4", you know. There was no way we could win, you know. But they were, as I say, foundational, wonderful, memorable years. When I went to college, Helen would write these long, long letters to me, making sure that I stayed in the strict and narrow path, that I would stay as a good boy. My roommates would read her letters and say, ah, another epistle from Helen, another epistle from Helen. Very supportive and very important. In fact, later on when I had to make a career decision, and I'll speak about that tomorrow, no, not tomorrow, I'll speak about that career development, the fourth day. When I speak about that, there were very, very significant people who had shaped and influenced me in that way. Let me back up a little. One of the significant things during those teenage high school years that occurred at home, I had observed my father bending over one day to kiss my mother on the cheek, and she brushed him aside. James spots that because he can see everything visually. And I remember asking mother, so love and affection is unexpressed, and I would say quite absent in terms of my parents' relationship to one another. Here, perhaps is something that I like to share with you that I think is very, very important. I think where I received my insight occurred as a senior at Valparaiso University. I took this wonderful class in sociology from Dr. Elsa Dronberger, who I will refer to her again. I'll refer to her again tomorrow. But she made us She gave a lecture one day on the characteristics of the rejected child. And as soon as she just began listing all those characteristics, bingo, you know, it opened up my whole world. That's me. And I think the Sunday school teachers and church people had sensed that in me. And so all I can say is that there was a lot of caring, a lot of patience, and there was a youth worker at our church from the Biblical Seminary in New York, a woman named Dottie Mack, who came and worked with us from the seminary. She was assigned to work in our church, whom I love, and I must have given her hell. I think I made her even cry one day. She was our choir director, and she was our youth worker, and she came, and I remember there were only four of us in the bass section, and we weren't paying attention. We were doing all these crazy things teenagers do, and she just cried in frustration in working with us, you know. But I remember many years later, when I was a student at the Biblical Seminary, I was now 28 years old, and she had come back to the campus. She's a missionary in Venezuela. She had come back to the campus for homecoming, and I just had to tell her what a wonderful witness she had been, and what a loving, caring person she had been to me, and that she was the person who had inspired me into wanting to go into the ministry. And she was so embarrassed to hear all of that. She just went like that. Oh, no, don't tell me that, James, you know. But I give thanks to people like Dottie Mack and Helen Liu for that. What else can I say?
You asked the question.
Yes. Ken, hello. Ken is a psychologist. Good therapy, Ken. Yes, sir.
You said you had an elementary teacher for several years. For a couple of years. It was very important to you, and that she said some things that you still remember. Did I hear you right?
Helen?
I don't know.
these teachers in high school?
No, elementary school.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I was wondering what that teacher said that was still memorable for you.
This was Mrs. Carboni. She was making reference to the different characteristics of the Japanese nation. And she was saying, she was describing how the Japanese nation was very quick to adopt Western ways. I never forgot that. And she was the one who made those kinds of comparisons. We spent time in class talking about that, which I had never forgotten. And I think today, when the world is much more conscious of the emergence of Japan and its economy and stuff that we've been covering and talking about here, there's so much evidence to corroborate what this fifth grade teacher was saying way back in the... I also spent 4 years in remedial speech and remedial English in high school. It's all one and the same. And I want to talk about some of that tomorrow in acculturation. I could say a few things now. As you can tell from my speech, I pretty well mastered the English language, but it was through a lot of effort. And one of the exercises Mrs. Perlman taught us at Brooklyn Tech was Rollicking Ronald Rode Riotously Home from Rio. Every Chinese person could appreciate what that is, that exercise, because most people from China, the R's are not used. So we've learned that. We've learned that well. I've learned that well. But nevertheless, high school, what was the problem was that we were living two worlds. There was a world in Chinatown that was home base, and that's Chinese. We spoke Chinese whenever we're back in Chinatown. So that when we went to school, it was English. And what happened to most all of us at that time, and my sister is still captured by it, is that she combines both languages so that we could start a sentence in English and finish it in Chinese, or we could start a sentence in Chinese and intersperse it with English words, and vice versa. And my sister, who has lived in Long Island all these years, still does that. But you know, that was a normal way of life. We understood everything, and I knew that pattern had to be broken, and that's my life at Valparaiso. I'll talk about that tomorrow, because in fact, that was the only way it could have been broken, and that is to pull myself out of Chinatown completely, which is what happened. But that's, I think, the full acculturation process started then, when I left Chinatown. Holly?
These are not connected. I was wondering if you would comment on the relationships between young men and young women in terms of what was permitted for you in terms of...
I had some wonderful close friends. Wonderful close friends. My mother hated that. Especially through my ballet classes and modern dance classes. After my freshman year at Valparaiso, I had an opportunity to be a dancer on the Broadway stage with Tea House of the August Moon. You know, you mentioned Tea House of the August Moon, and that fixes my generation and my age. You know, some of the young ones don't even, what is that, you know? But it was one of the first musicals on Broadway that involved a lot of Asian casts. And my teacher, I met him at Macy's. James, where have you been? Where have you been? I've been looking for you all over. Come here, you know. And he wants me to join Tea House of the August Moon. And I went, school was not my number one priority. I went home and excitedly told my mother, you know, hey, I have a chance to go be on Broadway. The pay is $250 a week. This is back in 1952, you know. And my mother said, James, once you go into that world, you're going to stop messing around with these dance girls and never go back to college. I had a lot of wonderful, sympathetic ears, and they were very supportive as well. Did I have your hand here? Yes. Yes, Holly?
The other part was just, what were your perceptions when China turned communist? Did that make any impact?
In 1949, yes. Not for us as children, but for our parents, yes. That was almost like a severance, a cutting off of the homeland. Up until that point in time, most all the older generations thought of China as home, and that they would retire there. They will go home. Once that occurred, then that language had to be eliminated. That expectation was gone. So they're mostly anti-communists. Yes. Yes.
I grew up as a second or third generation Norwegian Swedish person. That there was, my parents and grandparents could speak some of the language, and some of them were native Swedish. So I was curious. Have you taught your children Chinese, Cantonese?
No, we made a very intentional decision not to. For a number of reasons, my wife's dialect and mine are different. And we looked at, we said, how are we going to teach them Chinese? The most we would do is teach them a mixed up branded version of Chinese that will neither be comprehended by anyone when they begin mixing up the two dialects. So we said, let's just use English and maybe when they grow up, they'll have the interest and study it themselves. For example, I'm studying Mandarin now, and we learn both of us, we speak Cantonese, but the dialect I speak is from Hong Kong, and the one she speaks is from Tuy San, which is a rural section of Canton, and they're both different dialects. Significant enough that we didn't think it was worthwhile passing on. Besides, we were also aware that we were illiterate in that we could not read or write.
Oh.
And so whatever we passed on would be not a high quality Chinese. So we decided, well, why do that? Mm-hmm. I think if we were literate, I think we probably would have taken a different approach. Yes?
Were these years significantly different in the expectations for you and for your sister in terms of roles being defined for boys and girls?
Yes. Mm-hmm. My sister was number one child. She was the oldest. But the culture values males. So that as soon, I'm sure that if one entered into her psyche and put themselves into her life, she must have experienced extreme trauma and rejection when I came along. Because I wasn't privy to what was being said, but the contrast I'm sure was there, where the attention was shifted away from her. We were only 2 years apart, and not only was the, you know, when children are born, there is a normal sibling rivalry of attention getting from children expected of parents. But when you add the cultural dimension, where throughout all of her life, later on, there were expectations of her that she does not belong in the family. When she gets married, she is no longer a part of our family. She is a member of the other family. And therefore, she's devalued in the clan. There are all kinds of reinforcements that in effect says to her, she is not valued and not important. I didn't know this, but because she was 2 years older than I learned later on that when I was in college, she was expected to chip in money for my education. You know, and she was not expected to get educated. And so these variables have just, I'm sure, hurt her emotionally. And I use these painful words, because one of the very significant relationships is that for one reason or another, as a child when I was growing up, I couldn't understand why she was always beating up on me or making stories or putting me in a bad light and lying. And I remember playing the piano at home one day and she walks by, slams the keyboard on me, you know, bang, you know. She just did not like me. And it's a very painful experience in her world. And it was not until she reached her 50s when she began writing more gentle letters to me, less hostile letters. And in fact, for the past 2 years now, she's even written loving, caring letters to me. And now, I had enough training and insight to understand these dynamics and to see what has happened. But she never went for therapy. She's had to sort of plug along and resolve these views herself. And so in her midlife now, I think she's even written to me once and says, you know, James, I've always admired your talents in music. Well, heck, you know, she waits till she's 50 years old to tell me that. And I never thought, you know, much of it. So I think there was a lot of pain in the way she was reared. She was the only daughter. She was number one. And there were four sons after her. And she's expected to take care of all her brothers. When you find women in that kind of ordinal position in the family constellation, it's extremely painful. And I think that there's a little bit more time for your discussions than some of your sharing before the 5 o'clock time is up. My mother was Christian, but my father was not. He was Confucian. And but he went along with my mother's desire to send me to the mission. It was not the only show in town. There were many, many other social groups and activities. There were a lot of activities at the church that held me. And I think I was baptized early, when I was about maybe 8 or 10 years old. I forget the exact dates that I have. It was on Mother's Day, May 11th, either 1948 or 49, one of those two dates. But being a Christian was probably a lot of the direct work of the pastor himself, who gave me I went through confirmation class twice. I liked it so much. I was not left back, you know. There was so much meat to it, and so much to learn, and so I went through it twice. And he would share Kretschmann's commentary to me, and I'd read that stuff, and read the Gospel in Luke, and really became committed to Jesus Christ at that early age. And I can't say that the parents were very happy when I made that commitment. They would say, it's okay to believe, James, but don't believe too much. And you know, 25 years later, I heard the treasurer from my church council say the same thing to me. Pastor, it's okay to believe, but don't believe too much. You know?
Does that still exist in Chinatown? Do the children still have to cross Canal Street and run through the Italian neighborhood to get to school? And
things have changed. The church bought a piece of property on the corner of Mulberry and Worth Street. So that took care of the geography.
But the school too?
And the school is still there, but it's no longer open. It's now a senior citizen center. And the geography in Chinatown has expanded and spilled over onto the other side of Canal Street.
And do women more equal to their brothers now?
I'm not sure.
that might still exist.
Well, I thank you for your time. The bell has just rung. I wish you had opportunity to do, you know, more sharing of your own. If we had more time as an instructor, I would do that.